from WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. American environmentalists can claim a great history and legacy of accomplishment, from saving whole species to saving American wilderness and waterways. Now the movement is under attack, not just from hard-nosed leaders of the Bush administration, but from within the environmentalist community itself. The relentless advance of global warming and the failure so far to fully engage America against it has led a young pair of outspoken gadflies to charge that environmentalism itself is dead, that it's not up to the really big challenges facing the planet, that a fundamentally new approach is needed to rally Americans for survival. Old-school environmentalists say that kind of talk is itself dangerous, that it's dividing environmentalists just when they urgently need unity. But the call is for revolution, and it's turning heads tonight on Point, a controversial charge from inside the environmental camp that environmentalism is dead and that the planet's climate crisis needs a whole new approach. You can join the conversation tonight. Has the Earth Day generation and its approach outlived their effectiveness? Are they up to the mega challenge of global warming? Is there a better, bolder way to save the planet? You can join us tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Berkeley, California, is Michael Schellenberger, one of the so-called bad boys of American environmentalism. He's executive director of the Breakthrough Institute, a progressive strategy organization and communication strategist who consults on environmental and political issues. He's also co-author with Ted Nordhaus of a controversial essay entitled The Death of Environmentalism that's been shaking things up since its release at the annual meeting of major environmental group funders last fall. Michael Schellenberger, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thanks for having me, Tom.
So you are, within your community there, the bomb thrower. What's the bomb you're throwing? What are you saying?
Well, I think that we're articulating some ideas that have been circulating for a while. The difference was that we decided to say it in a rather public way. And there's a sense within the environmental community that you don't want to air the dirty laundry. You don't want to talk about what's really happening at a political and strategic level. And we felt like, look, we've lost all three branches of government to anti-environmental extremists. We're politically weaker than we've been in 15 years. We're making little to no progress at all on global warming at a political level. And we are also losing the war for American values. And that something had to be said because something needs to change.
So what do you mean environmentalism is dead, or talking about the death of environmentalism?
Well, we mean a few things. I mean, we're really starting at a conceptual level, we're saying that environmentalism as a way of thinking, as a way of organizing the world, as a way of understanding the world, and as a set of institutions which are self-designated to protect this so-called thing that we call the environment, that is moribund and it's dead. It needs to be buried so that something new can be born.
It's moribund, it's dead, and yet the environmentalists are the ones who are always talking about the planet, about the environment, about the water and air and all the rest. Why is it dead?
It's dead because it's no longer a useful paradigm for making the kind of changes we need to make. We're faced with a very serious ecological crisis, not just global warming, but also the destruction of the oceans, the loss of critical habitat. Human life is threatened, and these are human-caused problems. But when you call them environmental, it creates the sense that the problem is out there, that it's something that needs to be fixed, that it's a thing. And in fact, it takes us away from a kind of thinking that has been a part of environmentalism, though I would argue a minority strain, which is ecological thinking, the sense that all things are interconnected. And when we think that the environmental movement, the large institutions which are charged with spending the money, developing the policies, organizing the public to support some kind of a change, they have actually lost touch with that world of ecological thinking. And we wanted this to sort of bring them back to that and really think whether or not this category environment is useful anymore.
What we're going to hear later in this program from Carl Pope. He's executive director of the Sierra Club. He's pretty indignant at the whole idea that you've put out there and the way you've put it out. He says you've got it dead wrong, that membership is growing in a lot of these organizations. But you're pointing ultimately to, I guess, bottom line, global warming, saying if you can't stop that, that you're not worthy of the name environmentalist and it's not being stopped?
That's right. It's first of all, the reaction to this paper is really a symptom of the the death of the environmental movement. I mean, the American Librarian Association has bigger debates over the archival storage of newspapers than the environmental movement has over the fate of the species. I mean, there's major conferences every year that with peer-reviewed journals and scientists and activists coming together to figure out how to deal with AIDS in Africa or AIDS in Russia. Every professional association has some format for internal debate. We have nothing like that. And when Ted and I were invited to speak at a conference of environmental grant makers, we thought, well, look, here's a chance to actually have a conversation about how are we doing? What do we need to do differently? And I think the attacks on us, and they've been pretty relentless from the moment that we sent this report out, are just a sign of really how weak the movement is. If it can't sustain a little pamphlet, I mean, literally, this was a self-published pamphlet that we handed out to a few hundred people. If the movement can't kind of withstand that kind of a dialogue, then what good is it?
A pamphlet with a pretty provocative title at a time when environmentalists may already be feeling beaten up. What is it then, Michael Schellenberger, that you're prescribing as a response to global warming and all the rest? If you don't like the way Sierra Club and its ilk are doing it, what would you suggest?
Yeah, and I just want to start by also just acknowledging that we are really pleased and are very happy that Carl Pope has actually come into the dialogue, and really honored that he's going to be able to join the conversation tonight. Really, he's the only major environmental leader from the big environmental organizations who's actually taken the time to write something down and respond.
We'll hear from him. What's your prescription?
Yeah. Well, our prescription is that great social movements, like great corporations, are oriented and organized around core vision and core values, and that environmental groups right now are organized around problems and technical policy solutions. So we need to take a moment and figure out, what do we really care about? What are our core values? What kind of a world do we want? What are we offering to people? We've spent the last 30 years, environmentalists have, telling people what they can't have. Why they can't consume, why they can't grow. It's all a focus on the glass half empty. Yet progress, economic progress, has done terrible things to the forests and to the sky and to the water, but it's also done amazing things. I mean, we have, incredible quality of life in countries where there's been economic development. There's billions of people in the world that would love to have the kind of life that we have. And I think it's really to say, what kind of an economy do we want? What kind of a society do we want at a broad level, and what are the values that need to animate our advocacy so that we can achieve that vision?
And you want to wrap progressive politics, left-leaning politics, around this whole issue. What's the connection?
That's one of the many misinterpretations of this paper. People read a lot of their own things into this paper.
The word progressive written right through it.
No, actually. Well, I mean, I do believe in the value of progress. So for me, progress is a core value. And then the question is, how do you define progress?
Okay.
But what I want to say about what I think most of what we consider the liberal groups and the liberal movements have, in fact, all become special interests of one form or another. They've become complaint-based, and they've become technical policy solution-based, and they've lost sight of their core vision and values. I think that's true of the reproductive rights movement. I think that's true of the labor movement. I think that's true of a whole set of liberal movements. So what we are not saying that somehow these groups just all need to come together. They did that in trying to defeat President Bush and elect Kerry.
So unity is not enough. It's all about speaking to core vision and values, and that will produce what?
Well, we think it'll produce there was actually two pieces to what I was going to say. In the business world, they understand this very well, that great corporations are really firm and strict about their core values, but they're radically flexible and experimental when it comes to their strategies and tactics and products. The environmental community does just the opposite. We're actually – the movement is rigid around its products, in this case policy proposals, and rigid around strategies and tactics. So we've been pushing the same old – fuel economy standard increase for 20 years.
Michael Schellenberger, I got to ask you to stand by for a minute. We're gonna tease this out over the course of an hour, and we're looking forward to the conversation. To help us do that, I want to welcome into the conversation Judy Laser. She's with me in the studio tonight in Boston. She's assistant professor of environmental policy at MIT, author of The Environmental Case, Translating Values into Policy. Judy Laser, thanks for being with us tonight.
Thanks for having me.
We've got a couple of minutes before the break here. We're going to hear from Carl Pope in a moment. But what do you make of this brouhaha in the environmental community? I mean, here's what sounds like a call for a major departure, even a claim that it's dead, let's start over. What do you make of what's going on here, Judy?
Well, it's interesting. I actually see something quite different, which is that all these reactions to this internal challenge are a symptom of the vigor of the environmental movement. I think it's wonderful that there are challenges and that there are people responding to the challenge. So the fact that you're having this show at all tonight is a sign that, the movement is alive. I also sort of fundamentally disagree with some of the premises here. The environmental movement is an extremely heterogeneous movement. There are grassroots organizations, thousands of them around the country, organized around all kinds of issues and offering a variety of solutions. To critique the movement for having solutions at hand for when opportunities open is simply politically not very astute.
But what about the case Michael's making that, look, you're not winning the big battle on global warming, so you're fighting small battles. Yes, you've got policies, but they're not up to the big challenge. That's going to take, I don't know, a change in the public mindset, and that battle's not being won. What about that charge?
Sure. I think that's an important charge to talk about global warming because it is obviously the big hallmark issue. But global warming poses a very particular challenge to the United States political culture. We don't like to be the villains in our own stories. We don't like to have the victims be people in other countries and potentially not even us. We don't like stories that don't have a crisis in them, and that's global warming.
Well, and yet, it might be said that the crisis is growing out there. Judy Laser, stand by. We've got to take a short break. And Michael Schellenberger in Berkeley, California. We're talking tonight about a controversial charge from inside the environmentalist camp that environmentalism is dead. And the planet's health needs a whole new approach. You can join the conversation. If the world is still sinking into global warming, does that mean that environmentalism has failed? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about a controversial charge from inside the environmentalist camp that environmentalism is dead. You can join the conversation tonight. Have environmentalists been too narrowly, technically focused and failed to build a political consensus for change? Is the planet's health on a crisis path that requires an emergency reimagining of environmentalism? Or would that be the self-destruction of an important movement? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined tonight in the studio by Judy Laser. She's assistant professor of environmental policy at MIT. Glad to have her with us. From Berkeley, California, by Michael Schellenberger, one of the so-called bad boys of American environmentalism, who put out the essay last fall that has sparked this whole debate. He's co-author of the essay, The Death of Environmentalism. And right now, joining us from San Francisco, Carl Pope, executive director of the Sierra Club. He was appointed in 1992. Since then, the club has grown, added about 150,000 new members, growing to 700,000. It's helped protect nearly 10 million acres of wilderness. He is author of Strategic Ignorance, Why the Bush Administration is Recklessly Destroying a Century of Environmental Progress. He's laid out a rebuttal to the so-called Death of Environmentalism essay in a 17-page response. Carl Pope, we're very glad to have you with us tonight. Thanks for joining us.
It's a pleasure to be with you.
So here we are. I'm looking at your rebuttal to the case, and you begin by citing points of agreement. You say, A, we are making inadequate progress on global warming. B, we have inadequately mobilized public concerns and values. C, that this inadequacy is related to a common set of failings and weaknesses which afflict progressive social movements in general. You say you agree on all those three points with Michael Schellenberger and his co-author. So where's the disagreement come in, Carl Pope?
Well, the disagreement is that I don't think the death of environmentalism is any kind of solution. I think environmentalism is about life. I think the environmental movement is far broader, far deeper, and far more diverse than Michael's essay seems to have assumed. And I think you have to say, given that environmentalism has been quite successful in dealing with a host of other environmental problems, the air is now vastly cleaner in most American cities than it was 20 years ago, even though there are far more people and far more cars. Lake Erie is coming back. The bald eagle is substantially recovered. We've made a lot of progress on a certain kind of environmental problem. Mm. Global warming is a different kind of environmental problem, and we do need to reimagine our approach to that problem because there is something special about global warming. Most of us don't get up in the morning, get into our cars, and think about what our cars do to the probability of typhoons in the Bay of Bengal, but that is the reality. Our cars are shaping how often there are typhoons in the Bay of Bengal. That's a different kind of problem than air pollution that's right in my neighborhood. And we do need a different kind of vision and a more intense public understanding to solve it. But talking about the death of environmentalism, while it's intellectually very cute, really doesn't take us to a solution.
Carl Pope, I should point out, Michael Schellenberger was saying before you joined us that that he's honored to be talking with you, debating this with you, that he's pleased with the depth of response that he got from you in particular and not from some kind of, establishment members of the environmentalist community. So he's been tipping his hat to you. But the charges on the other side that he makes are that the big victories of the environmental movement are decades old now. And not that he celebrates the death of environmentalism. He posits it as a fact, that it's just not at grips with this bigger, new set of challenges that you and he describe, and that, in fact, it's not structured to work in addressing these. What do you say to that?
Well, first, environmentalism is a movement. It's a movement of millions of people. It's a movement of poets and scientists and activists and housewives, physicians. It's not dead. That is simply a nice intellectual construct, but frankly, it's hooey. The real question is, Michael analyzed in his paper a particular kind of expertise-based environmental advocacy. And he said that kind of advocacy won't solve the problem of global warming. I agree with him about that. That kind of advocacy isn't the environmental movement. It's just a handful of organizations that he chose to interview. I believe that what we need to recognize is we have here a dynamic and vibrant social movement, but it's not big enough. It is too deep on the coasts and not deep enough in the center of the country. We haven't enlisted the enthusiasm of America's small businessmen. We don't have farmers who are going to be among those who suffer from what happens to global warming as excited as we ought to about what's going on. We have a very big job to do of reviving the missionary energy of the environmental movement. And it's fair to say that missionary energy is not well represented in our nation's capital. It never is. But killing environmentalism or talking about its death is not a good way to get more people to go out and do missionary work, to talk and listen to their friends and neighbors, to bring to Americans the word that there are solutions to global warming. Mm-hmm. That's something Michael and I agree with. We both think that if we'll really tackle the problem of energy policy in an imaginative way, we can create millions of new jobs. That's mm-hmm. something most Americans don't know. We need to inform them. We can inform them as environmentalists. We can inform them as progressives. We can inform them as labor union organizers. I don't care what label we wear when we tell America the exciting story about the solutions to global warming. I just want more people doing it.
Carl Pope, Executive Director of the Sierra Club, please stand by. Michael Schellenberger, there are a lot of ways we can get into this conversation, and we'll come at it from a lot of angles. But let's just take Carl Pope's first assertion. Your fundamental thesis, environmentalism is dead, is a lot of hooey. Defend it.
Well, it's really a problem of the way that people conceptualize of the problem. So we interviewed Carl's colleague, the head of the global warming department at the Sierra Club, and we asked him, we said, you know, why do we even call this an environmental problem if that ends up communicating to people that this problem is outside of us, it's distant, and especially with global warming, it's really intangible. It's not the Cuyahoga River on fire. It's something that we hear will happen in the future. So what if we got people excited about transitioning the economy in such a way that we grew new industries around solar and wind or hydrogen and hybrids, if we revitalized the American automobile industry, made it competitive again?
You mean stop talking about environmental pathology, about problems?
Exactly. So it doesn't mean that you shouldn't ever talk about the global warming problem, but it does mean that the orientation is towards American greatness, about what we can achieve. And we interviewed Carl's colleague, and he told us, he said, look, you know, if we need to remember that we're the environmental movement, and our job is to protect the environment. If we lose our focus, there's no one else to protect the environment. We're not a union or the labor department. Our job is to protect the environment, not to create an industrial policy for the United States. And we went, this is a quote that Dan gave us over email.
Is he wrong about that? Are these bigger issues?
Well, the assumption
not,
is he says. Yeah. I mean, he says if you want people to act on global warming, you need to convince them that action is needed on global warming and not some ulterior goal. Well, why not persuade them that actually what we need to do is make an economy that creates 3 million new jobs through major investments in clean energy industries in the same way that we've invested in the past in the railroad system, the highways, the electronics revolution.
And what would you call that movement, if not an environmental movement? What label would you put on it? What flag would you raise for people to rally behind?
Yeah, I mean, the name that I like still is progressive, because it gives a sense of moving forward, of not moving back. But I think that the larger question is to get to this vision and values, is sort of what kind of a world do we want to imagine for ourselves, and do we want to communicate to others that we want to build? And then what kind of values should animate our work? What I hear about from Carl, and again, I'm deeply grateful that he's engaging in the conversation, is really that what we need to do is we need to talk about this being a pollution problem. That somebody's got to pay for the pollution problem, and we need to promote campaigns against coal-fired power plants, you know, NIMBY campaigns, essentially. And I think it's interesting that we're doing that, you know, that you've had an interest in this. I mean, you know, the environmental movement is diverse, but it shares one thing in common, and that's that it's dealing with problems that it's designating as environmental. And I'm interested in what are the consequences of that categorization.
Well, yeah, Carl Pope is engaging in the conversation, but he's been tough on you. He calls your argument a hodgepodge, an ill-thought-out assault on environmentalism. But Carl Pope, let me turn it to you. Are there not times when you look at the scale of the problems that the planet faces, the response and lack of response from the United States in the last decade, and your own approach, and do you not sit around at your own board meetings or wherever it may be and say, do we need a bigger umbrella, a bigger conception of what we're up to here?
I think we need a deeper understanding. We need to tap into people's deepest values, but the values that characterize environmentalism are the values of saying, you know, the future matters. We ought to be worried about what happens 200 years from now. We really do have to care about other forms of life. It's not just about human beings. Those are critical values to get people to care about what happens, how often there are typhoons in the Bay of Bengal.
And you're relating that to global warming.
Yes, not just when a typhoon happens. But when you get into your car in the morning, or when you go to the lot and buy a car, it is our job as environmentalists to help people understand in a deeper way the connection between their values and their behavior.
But Michael Schellenberger seems to be saying that's been done through a kind of narrow harangue rather than through a larger effort that would bring people somehow into the parade.
My book keeps approaching this as an intellectual construct, and I'm sorry. It's a mass social movement. It's happening in a million ways. Michael's talking about 25 interviews he had. There are tens of thousands of people doing environmental advocacy right now as we speak. And yes, I think it is possible for the environmental movement to become too focused on policy wonkmanship. I think that's a fair charge some of the time. The solution to that is to find the exciting poets, the missionaries, the visionaries, the local entrepreneurs of the movement, and give them more of the megaphone, not to say we have to kill the movement. This is a very arid intellectual conversation. It doesn't have any relationship to the feelings of people in Colorado who first set out in what Michael calls a NIMBY struggle.
Not in my backyard.
And they made some power plants in Colorado clean themselves up. And then they just passed in a state that was, you know, going for George Bush, so it's not a terribly environmental liberal state in most people's mind. They passed a requirement that 10% of their power come from renewables in the next 10 years. Now, that's only a first step. It is not going to solve the global warming problem. But once people take the first step, we believe the second step is easier. I don't want to have an arid intellectual debate about categories. I want to mobilize people in communities around their values, around places they love, around visions they have. I don't want to be Chicken Little. I do want to talk about visions and values. But I think this debate about we need to have a new category, environmentalism is dead, it reeks of academia, and it reeks of intellectual glibness. It doesn't connect with what's going on in Milwaukee this week.
Michael Schellenberger, I know you're going to want to respond to that. I want to get Judy Laser in here for a moment first, though. Judy Laser, I can well imagine listeners out there saying, who doesn't sympathize with Carl Pope? I mean, if you're into environmentalism, he's head of the Sierra Club. He's out there doing, you know, good work. On the other hand, we've got enormous problems, and we can look around and see policies that may not be friendly to the environment, see places where there's not the kind of progress some people might like to see. So maybe there is something not wholly up to the task in the environmentalism movement at large. Is this just an arid intellectual exercise, or is there a legitimate conversation about somehow stepping up the game?
Well, I like to think our intellectual exercises aren't arid. As an academic, I can tell you it's pretty lively there in the classroom, and we got a lot of students who are thinking about this stuff and really excited about it. We talked about it today in class, and people were fired up. That said, I have to say I agree with much of what Carl is saying about the environmental movement. The movement is animated by visions and values, just what Michael's talking about. What I thought he was going to say in his paper was that we really need to get back to persuading people to care about those visions and values, the environment. But he didn't. And I'm not sure, I still am not clear on what he wants people to care about. But I think the environmental movement has been pretty innovative, moving towards sort of place-based thinking and trying to reach out to people that traditionally, you know, in collaborative processes that they haven't been able to connect with. So I'm really, I actually find it one of the more flexible of the social movements that we see out there, very adaptive. So I guess I join Carl in being a little surprised by the charge.
Michael, step up to the plate here. First, an arid argument you've got going, and second, people aren't quite seeing what it is that you'd rather have done.
Sure. Well, there's real political implications for the way that we think about what the problem is and what gets included in it. And I'll give a couple of examples. We did a poll asking people an open-ended question, what is the biggest problem facing your community? We did the poll in Pennsylvania. It's a swing state in the presidential elections. It's a state the Sierra Club cares very much about. 2% of respondents said the environment. 68% said the economy. You know, the other percentages said something around national security, but there was a whole list of things that came before the environment. So why are we wedded to making our activism around this category that people, you know, yeah, they support it. If you ask them broadly, do you support it? But in fact, they don't support it very strongly. And that's the dirty little secret of the environmental movement. Yeah, you've got 70% of the country saying that they support environmental goals and the environmental agenda, but they don't support it very strongly. And if they did, you would have seen Kerry talking about it a lot more in the elections.
Well, let me ask you just on that.
Wait, you let Judith
You've got it. Go for it.
So, I mean, in terms of the NIMBY campaigns is actually a very important point. So you've got place-based activism, which Judith is holding up on a pedestal. What about the place-based activism against those wind farms off the coast of Cape Cod?
What about it?
Environmental struggle. Well, I think it's an indication that if the Kennedys aren't willing to have some windmills, you know, that blight their horizons slightly, then why do we expect China and India to forego economic development by not burning a lot of coal? You know, why do we expect the Chinese to not get what we have in terms of economic development? Yet that's really what gets demanded of them in environmental struggles. And it really comes from this conceptualization of what gets included in the problem and what doesn't. So when you say that that having an industrial policy is separate from the environment, the public hears that and they understand precisely what we're talking about. If you contrast the environment to the economy, then the environment is going to lose. And it's ironic that you know, that those of us that think that we're concerned with the consequences of economic development and progress are really buying into the basic categories that nature is separate from us, that the environment is separate from the economy.
So what's another way? Why do you think Europe has been more progressive in its environmental policies, for example?
Because the values environment is changing, and it's changing. Canada, Western Europe are getting more and more progressive in terms of their values. The United States is getting more and more conservative. You have increasing number of Americans that believe that pollution is necessary to create jobs. You have 10% more Americans saying that environmental groups are extremists. You have voters in Oregon not voting for anti-environmentalism, but voting for property rights and rolling back 20 years of environmental laws in one fell swoop. Carl chose not to talk about that. The environmental community invested $15 million and trying to elect John Kerry, and we lost.
Why fight with the environmentalists? Why not go out and fight for those Senate seats?
We need to find a way to offer a vision and a set of values for the American people that are far more compelling than the current environmental discourse is. And it's going to be around our future. It's going to be around the kind of country we can create, the kind of jobs that we can create. But when we get locked in this idea that the environment is a set of things that don't include working families, you know, that don't include the future of Detroit, you know, I mean, it's interesting. We've been failing for 20 years on fuel efficiency standards. You know, we've been, you know, that's one of the many failures.
On toughening
but
them
instead
up,
of,
yep.
Instead of rethinking our whole approach to making the American automotive industry competitive, we just continue to run full-page ads trashing Ford Motor Company. We continue to use the same tools that we've relied on for 20 years, and it's just not working anymore.
Well, we've got Carl Pope with us tonight, Executive Director of the Sierra Club. Right there, Michael Schellenberger, one of the co-authors of the essay, The Death of Environmentalism, that's shaking a lot of things up in the environmental camp. And Judy Laser is with us, Assistant Professor of Environmental Policy at MIT. We're talking about this controversial charge from inside the environmentalist camp that environmentalism is dead. What do you think? Why does American political support for green policies lag so far behind Europe's? Is there a better way to rally Americans here? We're at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about a controversial charge from inside the environmentalist camp that environmentalism is dead. And the planet's health needs a whole new approach. You can join the conversation. Is there a better way to rally Americans to the case, the cause of the environment? Has the Earth Day generation, the impulse, the approach, outlived its effectiveness, or is it needed now more than ever? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Joined tonight by Michael Schellenberger, one of the co-authors of the essay, The Death of Environmentalism, that got the environmental community in an uproar over the past few months. Carl Pope is with us. He is executive director of the Sierra Club, one of the country's biggest environmental groups. And Judy Laser is here as well, author of The Environmental Case, Translating Values into Policy. You can join the conversation, 1-800-423-8255. And a lot of people have been waiting. I want to turn to our callers. Richard is calling from Raleigh, North Carolina. Hi, Richard. You're on the air.
Hi. Thank you.
Sure.
I'd like to say it's a very interesting discussion. I have 2 points. One is, I think it's a mistake whenever you're trying to persuade the public to go around demonizing your opposition. And I think that there has been a lot of demonization of the Republican administration, maybe for good reason, but you know, you catch more flies with honey than you do with vinegar. The thing to tell Republicans is not that they're bad guys, but that they can make money off of the making things that are environmentally friendly or adopting policies. For example, take the Section 179 tax deduction. Why not lobby for that to be extended or even enlarged for small vehicles instead of huge monster SUVs?
So is there some relationship between the environmentalist movement and the approach that you would describe as vinegar? Is it implicit in that movement, or does it need to?
I don't think it is. I mean, you know, in any persuasion, you try to tell people what they can gain. And I think if you're dealing with a Republican administration, you might argue, well, look, let's give people, business owners, a big tax break for buying an environmentally friendly, let them write the whole car off in 1 year.
So let's talk net positives. We've got it, Richard, and thank you very much for your call. Let's get another caller in here. Dave is calling from Stowe, Massachusetts. Hi, Dave. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for this discussion. It's a great discussion. I'd like to suggest that we all need to think about this problem in a much, much bigger context. And I've been sitting here waiting and sort of panicking. What am I going to say? And I've actually clarified what I want to say a little bit.
Let's hear it.
I took a course in college 20-some-odd years ago called Economics of the Environment. And we were, one of your guests was speaking earlier about how we need to value things in the future, which is what being an environmentalist is all about.
Hard to do sometimes, but yeah.
Hard to do. It's in direct conflict with the way our economic system works, and that's where the problem is.
So you're saying remake not just environmentalism, but the whole economic system?
Well, we need to make some adjustments to it. Let's face it, the environment, I work in the energy conservation and renewable energy fields.
Yep.
The environment is about laws of science. You know, you can't put pollution in the air, you can't have estrogen-mimicking chemicals in your water supply, et cetera, because it's bad, especially for highly developed organisms.
Dave,
like
we got
ourselves.
It. So would you kill the environmental movement in order to make a bigger case, or would you work through that movement?
Well, I think that the movement, I think a lot of people in the movement understand this, what I'm saying implicitly. I think it's valuable. The NIMBY stuff and the Kennedys opposing a wind farm, that's a big problem. It's not seeing the bigger picture.
So let's look big. Let's look at the entire economic system. We're toting up the points as we go through here. Let's get another call. Ian is calling from New York. Hi, Ian. You're on the air.
Hi. I had a short comment that I was able to say several years ago, maybe 5, 10 years ago, that I was an environmentalist.
Mm-hmm.
I was clear on that. And today, it's difficult for me to know whether I am, partly because of all the new information, and partly because I know what's available.
New information, are you saying you're less persuaded today that there's an environmental problem?
No, I'm in terms of what technology is available and what's actually happening and how we're living day to day.
So why would you be less ready today to say, I'm an environmentalist?
Because I'm not sure if our daily actions are living up to it.
If our daily actions are creating environmental problems, do you mean?
Yeah, creating when there are other things available. And I think just the knowing more about it and having a greater grasp of it.
Yeah, so you're not so ready to put that label on. Ian, thanks for your call. Carl Pope, so there in the middle of that is a call for major economic change, change to our economic system to address global environmental problems. A, is that necessary? And B, if it is the environmental movement as it stands today up to proposing, pushing that?
Well, I think the major problem with our economic system is that we don't have the system we think we do. We say we have a market system, but when I go to the Safeway, I have to pay for what I take. And people who take things from the global environmental commons don't have to pay for them. If we actually charged people who consume carbon dioxide the real cost of emitting that carbon dioxide, it would be very cost effective to buy hybrid cars, and it would be completely unaffordable for almost anybody to buy a Hummer.
So you're seeing subsidies to environmental devastators and everybody else playing in the market.
And that's how we've done it, and it's a big part of our economy. Well, we all know it happens. We all don't understand just how large those subsidies are, how they slow down modern innovation, they slow down developing new jobs. Michael Schallenberger's right. We need to save the U.S. auto industry. The only problem is the environmental movement, and my own organization in particular as an example, have been working to try to save the U.S. auto industry since the 1970s. We've worked with the auto workers unions. We've worked with the auto companies. We told them they needed to catch up with the Japanese on technology and innovation. I've participated with dozens and dozens of meetings with auto executives and auto union leaders and
grassroots. But if after all that time it hasn't worked, Carl Pope, then is that evidence that supports Michael Schellenberger's
case? I mean, if you want to say why hasn't it worked, first, it has worked for the Japanese. They've just been nimbler and faster and swifter than the American companies. Now, there's some big reasons for that we need to look at. The fact that we make companies pay for health care and pensions in this country, and the Japanese and the Germans don't, makes our companies slower to innovate. And that is an environmental issue. Michael may say it's not an environmental issue. I have no problem at all as an environmentalist saying we need to get our economy fixed. We need to have the right kind of taxes. We need to have the right kind of regulations. We need to have the right kind of pension plans. Those are all issues that environmentalists are concerned about and should be concerned about, and that can be dealt with by the environmental movement, not all on our own. We can't be the labor movement as well, which is what Dan Becker was trying to say. But we need to work in close cooperation with and alliance with businesses, with labor, with people who are worried about the trade deficit.
But the question on the table, I guess, is whether an entirely revamped vehicle may be required for that. Let's get another call here. Jonathan's calling from Palm Springs, California. Hi, Jonathan. You're on the air.
Oh, thanks. I wanted to make a few points. I think to break up the roadblock to going ahead with important adjustments for a better future for mankind, it would be helpful to free corporations from the legal obligation of putting profits first.
It's not just a legal obligation. Their shareholders usually demand those profits, don't they, Jonathan?
Yeah, but not only that, but they're legally obligated to consider their needs first. And I think we could reprioritize it so the well-being of society, the environment, their employees have a greater priority, and still they'll be able to make profits because it will be a level playing field. The movie The Corporation made this point very well. My other point is that, I think corporations would benefit from that because a more holistic value system will give them more satisfaction in the long run.
So out with profits, in with a holistic value system. Michael Schellenberger, you're getting callers responding here to the notion of big changes, even profound changes in the economic system. Carl Pope says the environmental movement is in there pitching for the kind of change that will actually bring about environmental improvement.
And you know, and Carl truly has done great reaching out to unions, and I think he should be applauded for that. I think that what's interesting, though, is that we're having this conversation without really acknowledging that we've failed so badly. I mean, we have failed to raise fuel efficiency standards for 20 years, and yet, and I'd like to hear from Carl on this, the Sierra Club is pursuing the exact same strategy that it's been pursuing for 20 years. You'd think that if you were a corporation, for example, and your product wasn't selling anymore, you would find a new product to sell or new markets to go into. You would really reconceptualize how you were going to solve the problem instead of just battering away, battering away. We're weaker now in Washington than we were 15 years ago. You know, the values environment, and this is really the most devastating part of it, the core values and core worldview that people hold is getting more anti-environmental. It's getting more conservative.
That
so
people
how
hold
do we
globally or
that?
In America?
In the United States, in Europe and Canada, it's actually going in the other direction, which is reflected in its public policies. But I think that I just want to kind of focus on this a little bit. Here we've like failed miserably politically. We failed miserably at the policy level. And I'm not hearing a change of course from Carl. And I'm kind of wondering, at what point do you kind of go, we got to try something really different?
We've got it. We've just got a couple minutes left. Let's get Carl Pope's response. Mr. Pope.
I've been advocating changes in course over the years. We changed course in the Sierra Club in 1973. We changed course in the Sierra Club in 1993.
But if the country's course isn't the right one, you know.
Let me finish. I mean, Michael's view that the environmental movement is just doing the same old, would be a damning indictment if it were true. It simply isn't true. And I would point out that it's not just environmentalists who have been doing badly politically. All social movements in the United States that are focused on justice have been doing badly. And that is in part because of the kind of values changes Michael is talking about. The question here isn't whether we need big changes. The question here is whether death is a useful way to think about those changes or whether we ought to think about growth, not death.
Got it. Judy Laser, we've just got a minute left here. How do you see this? A big whack of the beehive by Michael Schellenberger and his co-author with this essay. Is this a productive conversation for the environment, for the planet?
Yeah, I actually say I think we should thank Schellenberger and Nordhaus for bringing up something really important, which is this idea that American support for environmentalism doesn't go very deep. I think that's right, and I think we have to figure out what to do about that. It's been exacerbated by this 30-year campaign by the Republicans to take over the language and ideas of politics, and that's probably something else we need to take on, environmentalists and every other social.
Is that going to require a kind of revolution in the other view, the counter view, to produce?
I think it's going to take a long, slow campaign and probably will take us a decade or more to get there.
Well, a decade might be a reasonable time if they can succeed in that time. Judy Laser with MIT, thanks very much for being with us tonight. Carl Pope, Executive Director of the Sierra Club, wonderful of you to join us. Thanks very much for being with us tonight.
Thank you.
And Michael Schellenberger, co-author of The Death of Environmentalism, thank you for being with us tonight. Very thought-provoking.
Thanks so much, Tom.
Listeners, you can continue this conversation at onpointradio.org in a moment, a check-in on the reconstruction of the tsunami-stricken Indonesia. This is On Point. Another 788 bodies were discovered this weekend in Indonesia, bringing the total of those killed or missing from December's tsunami to over 240,000 in that country. Meanwhile, after being in the center of a media crush for weeks, life now goes more quietly on for survivors, as does the task of rebuilding lives and villages. Last week, the U.S. scaled down its presence with the departure of the aircraft carrier USS Abraham Lincoln, but relief work continues. Dan Curran has been in Banda Aceh, Indonesia, for the past 35 days, working with the aid organization Mercy Corps. In this radio diary, he gives an update on how Banda Aceh is recovering 6 weeks after the tsunami.
The devastation was so immense that actually when you first see it, you don't imagine that it can be cleaned up or where you would start. But having said that, I'd say in and around Banda Aceh itself, the main city and the environs, there's been a rapid progress. People have salvaged a lot of the wood and scrap metal, and there's probably 200 trucks and backhoes and bulldozers working their way through the rubble, moving it outside the city, filling in areas that were flooded. So it depends on your perspective. I was meeting today with some folks from a Canadian embassy that had flown in, and they had just seen the first time they'd seen the damage. And you could see that they were in a mode of thinking how horrible it is and where do you start. And those of us that have been here for a while, I look around and say, wow, we're really making progress. The people are amazingly strong here. I've worked in a number of relief and development situations, and I have never seen such knowledge and skill in people's abilities to get back to their work and also motivations. They're moving three steps ahead of us. They're going back to their villages. They're building. They tell us that they're going to do that, and we come back a week later, and they've already put up a structure, and they're trying to get their boats fixed. And all in the midst of this, they've lost their family and their home. And I met some men from a village called Lambada 3 weeks ago. And the village before the tsunami had about 3,000 villagers, and most of them are fishermen. Following the tsunami, there's only 400 left alive, and only 100 of them are women, and only about 15 are children. These men said that they wanted to return to their home, and I went with them, and there was nothing there. And I said, what are you going to do? How are you going to live here? You can't live here. And they were incredibly positive. They said, we're going to come back. We will. We're going to return. You watch. In 2 weeks, you'll see. And I went back about 3 or 4 days ago, and they've already moved back there. They're working on their boats. They're living and sleeping in the mosque that's still standing. We've been helping them get a water well in and helping them with some temporary shelter. And they're moving forward. There is a working market here, and there is a working society. And the urgent needs are not health or food or material aid like clothing or any of that. That's all met. The real urgent needs are to try to get people back into homes, get water systems up and running, get some sort of electricity to them, and then help them get their livelihoods back. As usual in these situations, it's really amazed me at the strength of life in people, that you really will meet people that are out there that are just strong. And every time I run into people like that, I think, how would I carry on having lost in really just an afternoon? You keep hearing repeated stories of people that lost their entire family. Some lost their entire village out on the West Coast. And it just reminds me of just the strength of people and what we're capable of if we're having to face something like that.
Dan Curran is director of the Humanitarian Leadership Program at Harvard Business School. He spent the past month doing tsunami relief work in Banda Aceh, Indonesia, for the organization Mercy Corps. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
On Point with Tom Ashbrook is a production of WBUR Boston and NPR, National Public Radio.
Support for On Point comes